You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
I want to say that today we are superimposing the library's mission of free access to ideas and information to that of the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, which is to enrich and connect our community through intimate and transformative musical experiences, which I think today will be. Ever since reading his remarkable essay, A Life in Piano Lessons, in The New Yorker, I have been so eager to hear and meet Jeremy Denk. In fact, the title of today's program, Beautiful Acts of Attention, come from Jeremy's essay, and I think it will be aptly titled. So today, I'm very deeply honored to present Jeremy Denk as part of our Spring Aloud series. Now, it is my deep pleasure to introduce Rachel Fine, who is the executive director of the LA Chamber Orchestra.
Thank you. Collaboration drives the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra's strategic vision, and I'm so pleased that we're able to leverage our resources collectively and make this great program accessible together. I'm also lucky enough to be able to say a few words about our guests of honor this afternoon. It's hard to think of two figures in music today who excel in as many diverse ways and on as many different platforms as Jeffrey Kahane and Jeremy Denk. Some of you may have first encountered Jeremy's writing in his beautiful essay he wrote for The New Yorker last spring, mentioned by Louise, a memoir of his education as a young pianist. Others might have learned his name when he was named a winner of the MacArthur Foundation's so-called Genius Award last year, joining a class of honorees that included an astrophysicist, a medieval historian, and a paleobotanist. The MacArthur Foundation praised him as a concert pianist, enlivening the musical experience for amateurs and aficionados alike through his eloquence with notes and words. Jeremy has long been known to those of us in the classical music world as a pianist who is an innovative interpreter of music by Bach, Ligeti, and Charles Ives. Jeremy is the music director of this year's 2014 Ojai Music Festival, which he has organized in part this year as a tribute to the memory of Charles Rosen, whose 1972 book, The Classical Style, Denk as librettist and composer Stephen Stuckey, have turned into a comic opera that will have its premiere as this year's festival. As a pianist and writer, Charles Rosen had a sophisticated but inclusive way of bringing composers and their music to life. And that legacy is very ably being carried on and expanded by Jeremy and his own wide-ranging work. This afternoon, Jeremy will be joined in conversation and performance by a fellow pianist and polymath, Jeffrey Kahane, the music director of the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra. Like Jeremy and Charles Rosen, Jeffrey has a rare ability to communicate both musically and verbally with that same eloquence that the MacArthur Foundation praised in Jeremy. We at the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra are very pleased to be presenting Jeffrey and Jeremy together in a pair of concerts next weekend, on May 17th at the Alex Theater in Glendale and on May 18th at Royce Hall, with a program featuring Bach, Mozart, Ligeti, and Beethoven. We thank all of you for coming today and warmly invite you to join us for one of those performances. Please join me in welcoming Jeremy Denk and Jeffrey Kahane.
Hi, Jeremy.
Hi.
This is an incredible treat for me because Jeremy, in addition to being my friend, is one of the musicians I admire most in the world. And he's also, as Rachel mentioned, and as I think probably all of you know, an exceptional writer about music. And I wanted to start by citing this... Nobody really knows who said this. You've probably all heard it. It's been attributed to everyone from Laurie Anderson to Frank Zappa to Martin Mull, which is the famous dictum that writing about music is like dancing about architecture. And so I wanted to ask you, first of all, what's wrong with dancing about architecture?
There's nothing. Actually, that's my complaint about that quote.
Right.
You always hear whenever you... Right. I think dancing about architecture would be fascinating.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, like writing a... We write about everything we write about. Writing is a sort of weirdly privileged or universal thing. It's not exactly like dancing.
Right.
We don't dance about groceries. Maybe we do. I don't know. At least I don't. But writing is, I mean, why wouldn't you write about music? I mean, respecting all the problems and incompatibilities. And those are legion, of course.
And of course, there's an extraordinary tradition of writing about music, not only, I mean, going all the way back to Aristotle, of course, but wonderful music criticism, E.T.A. Hoffmann and Schumann and Debussy and so many others. And you are in the process, I gather, of formulating a book.
True enough. Guilty as charged.
Yeah. And the book stems from an article that you wrote, this beautiful article that Rachel referred to in The New Yorker. And I wonder if you would just talk a little bit, we can get back to the idea of writing about music later, because I do have some specific things I wanted to ask you about that. But the title of this event today was Beautiful Acts of Attention, and I don't know if that was drawn from that specific article or from some other place, but a lot of that article was about the process of developing as a pianist and mm-hmm. practicing. And I have often felt that becoming a pianist, the greatest challenge of becoming a pianist or any kind of musician is not learning how to play the instrument, it's learning how to practice. Uh-huh. And I wonder if you would speak to that a little bit and how that has figured in your own development as an artist, the art of practicing.
Well, I mean, I have all the same probably memories. Maybe you have these too when you're 12 or 13, that you're sitting there a certain number of hours at the piano, and then some percentage of those hours, you have no idea why you're there, but you feel you have to be there in order to put in the muscle training and whatever. Sometimes you're learning a new piece, so then you know, you're just trying to get the notes under your fingers. But then you get to a certain point, and what's next? And Shebok, and the whole New Yorker article was basically, in many ways, an excuse for me to talk about Shebok, who was a kind of unearthly and uncanny genius, both physically at the piano and in terms of also the beauty of the metaphors that he would deploy to explain music. And Shebok used to always say that he wished he could practice with each one of us an hour every day, mm-hmm. if there were enough hours in the week to sit with each one of us and practice, because inevitably what he ended up doing in lessons was sort of proto-practicing.
Right.
And of course, when you're a college student, sometimes you sort of say, oh, I've absorbed that lesson, and now I'm done knowing that in this Mozart Rondo theme that each bar has a different rhythmic emphasis, and therefore the whole beauty of the theme only happens if you practice in these little changes. And you often feel, I've learned that, he told it to me, but what he was doing was telling you how to practice it and how to hardwire it and how to discover it. And he was very interested in the sort of interplay of the ballet, the physics, the movements, right. and the kind of intangible and impossibly ethereal. And sometimes it was almost comical how far off in the clouds he would go, and then sometimes it was incredibly amazing how close to the... And he was constantly traveling back and forth between those two extremes, right. from this goes down here, the wrist goes down here, and then it comes up. When the phrase goes, the physics of this, or sometimes just treating the arms like, sometimes, thinking about this hinge, and sometimes thinking about this hinge,
right.
Like a sewing machine almost at times, or the curves of, and then, things like, I quote in the article, to show love for someone, but not to feel that love is the work of Mephistopheles. Mm. And that was somehow going to explain the way that you played Bartok, but
I am so glad actually that you brought the word metaphor in so early in this discussion, because one of the great gifts that I was given early in my training here in Los Angeles was the opportunity to work with a very great pianist, Jacob Gimple, who came here in the 1930s, emigrated, and really was one of the very great pianists. And in a way, a little bit like Shebok, didn't have anywhere near the kind of recognition that he deserved as a pianist. I mean, Shebok was a titanic, a really great, great pianist. And I'll, for many of you may not know who we're talking about. In a minute, I'll ask you to say a little bit more about him. But Gimple taught through metaphor. And I remember specifically one night, one of his master classes, where he turned all the lights out in the living room. He had classes in his living room. And he, at a moment where a certain chord was played, then he turned all the lights on. Mm-hmm. And the use of metaphor was constant. And it's particularly poignant to me because I've always used that in my own teaching. But as a music director, as a conductor, in this day and age, one has to be incredibly careful working with orchestras. You know, you start using metaphors. And
that's such a great thing that happens to me all the time. I'll say, you know, this phrase should be like...
Right.
You know, and then they look at you and they're like, slower, faster, louder.
Yeah.
they really generally don't like that very much. Well, because one metaphor to 90 people results in 73 different executions very often. Yeah.
But I think it's such an extraordinary thing to... It actually brings us back to this whole idea about writing about music or speaking about music, because... Paradoxically, I think the greatest teaching that I know comes, of course, through the use of words. It has to come. Not always, but often it does. For those who may not know who Shebok was, can you just say talk about him a little bit?
Right. George Shebok was a Hungarian pianist who was captured prisoner of war during World War II, and he ended up in Paris, and he was very close with Janusz Starker, who probably is more familiar to most people, and they were very long-time recital partners. And then, but he recorded a number of very well-regarded discs in the 50s, and then... Yeah.
I grew up with the Brahms cello sonatas with Starker and
Very beautiful. Yeah. My favorite thing they ever did together is this Mendelssohn Variations Concertant. Mm. And the things that Shebok does in that piece, the kind of nuances and the... on top of just sheer technical... you know, astonishing greatness of octave playing and passage work. But the kind of wit and the tenderness of that performance is like everything about Shebok to me that I remember. He ended up coming to Bloomington right in the glory days when Dean Bain was recruiting all of these Europeans to come, Joseph Gingold and Starker,
Menachem
Frankel
Pressler,
Gulli, and Pressler. And tremendous convergence on the cornfields. So he ended up, he was there from the mid-60s until he died, more or less. And he taught in Paris and Tokyo other parts of the year.
And just to go back a little bit to the article morphing into a book, would you like to say anything about that process, where it is now, you hope it will end up?
Well, it sounded like a really good idea when I signed up. It's very similar to the opera to expand this piano lessons narrative. Luckily for the New Yorker article, I had this marvelous natural resource, which was the notebook that my teacher kept of my lessons from age 11 to age 15, more or less. Very important. And of course, this notebook also had marvelous drawings to indicate, you know, how it had gone. So it had sometimes a star that was beaming with pride for something that was great, and sometimes if it was particularly bad, there would be a slug. Sometimes the star was limping without one leg, and there was even one toilet, as I remember. So the notebook has this wonderful quality of the sort of him trying to keep me on the rails and train me and yet inspire me at the same time. And so I had all this raw material to do that part of it. And I had very vividly in my mind these memories of Shebok lessons, which are closer to me in time. And then I had, of course, the present day, now I have to sort of expand this idea of piano lessons and more memories of piano lessons and tell the story more completely. I basically skipped over my Oberlin years, where I basically studied with everyone.
Right.
Which is always a terrible idea, actually. But I got a lot out of it.
I did the same thing.
Oberlin had that sort of weird... Because I would also, being very avid for chamber music, I would just play... I wanted to play everything. That's what a lot of college students get into... Conservatory students get into a lot of trouble doing that, actually. Because you're so excited about all the music. And I played for voice recitals. I played for every string recital. And I...
You know.
So I have all those lessons. I have a lot of memories of those lessons, which are going to go in the... Well, we'll see. I'm still working on structure, which is a problem.
Structure. Well, we're going to talk a lot about structure.
Yeah.
I can't resist saying this, but you know, I was born here in Los Angeles. I grew up here, and I started taking piano lessons when I was 5 or 6 years old. And my very first piano teacher is here, Howard Weissel. Howard, where are you? There he is.
Oh, wild.
So. And I don't remember you ever putting a slug or a toilet on any of my stuff. I think I got little stars, maybe. I don't know. But anyway, we're going to play something for you. But I just wanted to, before we do, you mentioned chamber music and your sort of your omnivorous nature, which I think we share that. And we share sort of an interesting sort of quirky thing, I think, about our careers is that in an earlier stage of our careers, we each of us spent... quite a number of years, I think, playing as a collaborative pianist with a very major figure.
Right.
You with Josh Bell and me with Yo-Yo Ma. And being in that role, a little bit like Shabak was with Starker. It's a peculiar thing because any great musician like Josh or Yo-Yo knows, of course, that in fact... The Brahms sonatas are called sonatas for piano and cello. They are, right?
Yeah,
all the violin sonatas are called sonatas for piano and violin. And and yet the perception, of course, often we're perceived as accompanists. But there is something, I think, in a way, sort of salubrious about that, you know, the humility that's required to do that. But more important, just the experience of devoting oneself to that kind of collaborative music making. And I wonder if you would talk.
Yeah, well, I learned a lot from that. I spent 7 years, more or less.
Yeah, it was about the
reasonably
same.
Full time.
Yeah.
Well, Josh had periods right. of the year that he liked to do recitals. And it was about 6 weeks. And it took about, you know, 8 months to recover from them. So, but they were very packed.
You know, right.
It'd be like 30 concerts in 40 days or maybe less sometimes. And it was a lot of flying and a lot of just getting up there, no matter how exhausted you were
and
making music. I learned a lot from that process. And I learned a lot. Of course, Josh and I now know each other musically extremely well, almost embarrassingly well.
Yeah.
And we know each other's tendencies and, you know, Josh's approach is so deeply communicative, and maybe you could say that the prime directive of his playing is communication.
Yeah,
yeah, and that's kind of it's a wonderful prime directive, and it and I had to absorb myself into that to that ethos and that way of playing, that way of thinking, on top of the sheer experience, I came out of it. I think a better musician and better capable to go out on stage and communicate myself. It's interesting. It was exhausting.
We used to do, you know, seven recitals in 7 cities in 7 days, flying every day.
Josh would often say after we got back off stage, another one bites the dust. We'd often sing it. Which is this sort of mentality that takes place after a while at each event, you know. But it's funny how that sort of ritual of playing every night is... Actually, the music making, in some ways, for at least for a few weeks, gets better and better.
It does. It's true, yeah. Well, speaking of collaboration, we have 3 little musical interludes we planned, so we're going to play for you first. This seems... I didn't plan it this way, but very appropriately, some... It's not Hungarian music, exactly. We're going to play some Bach. This is a chorale prelude, organ chorale prelude arranged by the great Hungarian master Gyorgy Kurtág. So,
famous stories of Kurtág also. We'll get to that later.
This is called Gottes Zeit ist der allerbeste Zeit. God's time is the best time.
I'm here, right?
Oh, wait. Oh, we were going to do that last. Sorry.
Which one do you want to do first?
Should we do this one first?
Sure.
All right. Never mind. This is called O Lamm Gottes unschuldig. O Lamb of God. There's some amazing, amazing YouTube videos of Kurtág and his wife playing four hands. His wife, both of them are wonderful pianists, and they play this music with... Have you seen those? They're just...
I haven't, no.
Absolutely extraordinary.
Stephen Isles told me there was a wonderful story about Kurtág that they were sitting down to rehearse, and Kurtág played like the most delicate kind of two Fs, like just a unison, like pianissimo, just gorgeous. She said, "Boy, you're such a lout today. Why are you such a pig? Why are you playing like such a pig today?" They had this incredibly refined sensibility, the two of you.
Yes, know. Right.
As you can hear from that very gorgeous and kind of transparent and uncanny transcription, right?
Yeah.
It's all marked pianissimo, right? Yeah. Almost all of it are quadruple.
And this wonderful effect of the... it's meant to imitate the very high... descant stop, that's not what you call it, whatever, on the organ. So this very almost inaudible sound, like a distant harmonic. It's beautiful.
Right.
So the core of this topic to be to talk about a writer about music who I think for each of us, and probably for many other people, is, if not the, certainly one of the supreme exemplars of the art of writing about music. He was a great musician himself. And that's Charles Rosen. I was going to bring my copy of The Classical Style because I still have the copy somewhere that I bought in 19, I don't know, when I was in...
It's okay, I have it from memory, so it's fine.
I wasn't planning to recite it, but I wanted to show it to people because it looks like my copy of Marcello Hazan's Italian Cooking. It's that dog-eared and stained.
Mine does too, largely because... Tom Morris imprisoned me in a house in Ojai to finish this libretto for the opera for 2 weeks, and there was a pool. And I largely wrote the libretto by the pool and dripped copious pool water all over my copy, so it's very... Right.
Well, it is arguably... I mean, I have a pretty large library of books about music, some of which are good, some of which are not so good, and a handful of which are truly great, and this is... one of the great books ever written about music. Yeah. And I'll just turn it over to you ask you to talk about, and you actually knew him, and...
I knew him very well, yeah, last 6 years of his life, anyway.
So
Charles, of course, tremendous pianist, and he played a lot, particularly, I think, in the 60s and the 70s.
Yeah.
Maybe somewhat less, but he still played pretty continuously through the end of his life, and he wrote this sort of epic-making book, The Classical Style, in 1970. And that book is, it's just, he claimed he had the idea from another book that someone did on three genius artists, and now I forget who they were. But he's like, I could do a book like that on three people, Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven. And of course, the story of the book is partly the way those kind of three people built on each other's discoveries. Haydn, of course, being the first one, and then Mozart coming along, and the two of them, and obviously... Haydn's encounter with Mozart seems to have affected his composition, and later Haydn is more attuned to certain niceties of proportion, but it also, everything seems to be a little more imbalanced, the wildness and the sense of overarching design. And then of course, Beethoven comes along. And so it's kind of a page turner about the way these three people worked, ever more incredible ways of stretching a style. And basically, the style, the classical style, Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, is a kind of a fountain of cliches, right? It's just tropes, generalities. It's music that, in a way, almost anyone could write. And they did, right? Because it had a certain accepted style, right? And then how do you take that sort of thing, which would be a little bit like maybe even the style in which a romantic comedy is written now, or the style in which a certain kind of really well-known, well-plowed set of possibilities, and find a strategy for making it into something truly great.
The epigram at the beginning of the book is a quote from a German play, which two characters are discussing. One of them says, "Why do you keep using that idiotic word, classic?" Mm-hmm. And the other says the word isn't idiotic, it's just often used idiotically.
that actually is a line in the opera.
I figured it was too good to pass up.
It's in the very first scene of the opera, it's said, yeah. But
so how do you make an opera out of a book like The Classical Style?
I have no idea, but basically, I mean, this, as I said, it's of course it's beyond preposterous to make a opera out of a musicological text. So you first have to embrace the absurdity of it. But then I started looking for what is the plot of The Classical Style. And part of the plot is this sort of emergence. It's kind of a birth, life, and death story.
Right.
So basically music, Charles talks a lot about the sort of slight chaos of musical style between 1750, 1770. Everybody trying various things, but things are much simpler and much more... compartmentalized into four-bar phrases, much more about little discrete bits, but somehow nothing yet totally made sense structurally. And so how out of that chaos emerged, crystallized this set of possibilities, this set of great ideas that Haydn had and Mozart. And then as it grows and grows, and then this sort of life cycle of the style where Beethoven gradually takes the fundaments of harmony that have been the foundation of this style, and he begins to kind of whittle everything away but the fundaments again. Right. He takes all the trappings of the classical style in a way, starts, yeah, like vacuuming them away, and then suddenly makes you see again the building blocks, but in a completely transformed and, you know, unbelievably inspiring way, like in the late Beethoven sonatas, or the sort of ways that there's a great passage where Charles talks about the cadential, you know, every cadenza in it's the most, every cadenza in classical ends with one of these, right? You come to it, and then there's that amazing place in 111 where, right? Well, now I forget how it goes.
Right.
Something like the,
right.
I've played this piece so many times, I can't believe I can't remember it right now. And he gets stuck on this cadential trill, right? That
right.
becomes...
goes into the minor and then ends up in E flat major, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And the way that's how Beethoven refocuses. So that's sort of the end of the life cycle of the classical style, is when the music becomes about the musical conventions again.
Right.
So
do you play... which of the three cadenzas for the Beethoven First Concerto are you?
I play the big bomb.
Because also there's an incredible joke in that about the cadential trill, right?
Yes, right. Where there's a trill about 3 minutes in.
Just exactly where you think that exact figure comes, and it sounds like this enormous cadenza, which is already way too long.
Yes.
I mean, it's incredibly inspired and wonderful. It's not really too long, but it's vastly out of proportion to almost any other cadenza of its period. And he finally comes to the cadential trill, and then he keeps going and writes another page of music.
And the conductor, if they don't know, sometimes freaks out, which is the best part.
Yes. And you get to see the whole orchestra go like this, and then they go, oh.
Yeah. Well, that's the idea. I mean,
of course.
And that's kind of a recurring theme in my writing about music. And, you know, that's obviously a theme of the opera.
Right.
Also that... Charles says in his inimitably perceptive fashion that the structure of the classical style is built on the structure of comic opera. That
yes,
is,
that's right.
The four-bar phrase, the easily distinguishable bit of music, and the constant change-up of character from one on a dime. You know, four bars of this, and then four bars of its opposite, and then two and two, and everything is built on the switcheroo.
That's right.
Kind of.
And then, of course, in Haydn, you have... And Haydn's audiences were so finely attuned to this, you have the four-bar phrase that all of a sudden becomes a five-bar phrase.
Right.
And it's like this almost like slapstick quality, this sort of pratfalls, you know.
Indeed. So that in that spirit, I'm not quite as ashamed of all the slapstick in the opera. But,
no, I
think... But, yeah. Well, yeah.
You are going to actually play a little Mozart for us, but before you do, I have a very... Maybe it's not a peculiar question, but there's something about you that I learned. I hope this is true. It's not a bad thing. But I seem to remember reading that you got a double degree in music and chemistry at Oberlin.
I did.
Is that true? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I mentioned it, you use the word building blocks, and one of the things about Rosen's book and about your writing is the way in which it's almost like I often feel like you and Rosen and a few handful of other writers, you know, will hold up, it's almost like peering at a musical molecule through a microscope.
Uh-huh.
And there's one other pianist that I know who also... is a chemist by training. I mean, has a Melvin Chen, who's now at Yale.
Yeah, I know Melvin.
Also has a degree in chemistry. But I don't know. I just wonder if, you know, it seems like an odd thing to say, but in a way there is a beautiful kind of poetically scientific or scientifically poetic way that both you and Rosen look at music and talk about it. This idea of, you know, molecular, looking at it at the molecular level. And how those molecules...
How they work.
How they're
getting
work.
In, how do they tick, and how do they react with each other to create things. I mean, I did sell all my chemistry textbooks 1 minute after graduating.
But nobody made you.
It may take slightly more than a minute to get from the quad to the bookstore, but as fast as it took to get there. And I've forgotten a tremendous amount of the, you know, and I was obviously found myself very attracted to my English classes, as well as
right.
my parents, of course, thinking, you know, one degree in piano and another in English were not entirely thrilled. But I stuck with chemistry, and probably that's true. I mean, I think the idea of a phrase or a unit of music, a few notes having kind of a little unit of energy in them,
right.
like a force or a vector, a right. thing. And that was my Juilliard dissertation, actually. It was a extended manifesto against the way that musical form was taught at Juilliard. And it was
I'm
about
right with you there, how would you, brother.
Because we always have these classes when you begin to learn about classical music in the conservatory. You get a class called Form and Analysis, in which they teach you, you know, a phrase and a motive and then a ternary form. And everything in the class is basically nouns, right?
Right.
Labeling nouns. This is a that and this is a that. And it seemed to me very important that the fundamental generative unit of musical form was a relationship between two things.
Right.
Like a verb. Verbs should be the... Yeah. The basic. Yeah. And, you know, some people liked that idea. Some other people didn't think that was really practical. But I still feel that's basically an important important thing.
Yeah. Will you play a little Mozart?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm actually going to go down here because I feel weird sitting up here while you're playing. So.
Uh-huh. I'm going to play the... Rondo, K. What is the K of that rondo? 494. 494. In F. Thank you.
So beautiful. I would love to have you tell us about Ojai. I know that I looked at the programs and they're just so rich and amazing, and so many wonderful people, some of whom have also Timo Andrus, who's one of, well, I think, for those of you who have not heard the name Timo Andrus, you will. I think one of the great young composers, also an extraordinary pianist. He's going to be there, and Brooklyn Rider, right? Fantastic string quartet, and The Knights, the remarkable chamber orchestra. And anyway, just if you want to give a quick overview about what's going to happen at the festival, in addition to the opera, of course.
Well, sure. It's a festival that started with the theme of, as we were talking about, one of the important things for me in Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven, for example, is the way that they screw with you and your expectations, right? That the music has this way of undermining your complacency.
Right.
And so this mirror idea emerged of sort of screwing with the canon. Obviously, the classical style is part of that, which is basically music about music. Right? Mm-hmm. And what would the tonic harmony say if they had an aria? What an aria about arias, and, you know, Beethoven addressing Schroeder about his fate as a great composer, and all these. Actually, that ended up on the outtakes. So another thing that came up with this same sort of theme in mind was Uri Kane's kind of amazing jazz rewriting of Mahler, where he takes elements of Mahler and explodes them into these kind of collage. He takes what's already implicit in the music and makes it weirder. And then there's also a large canonade, which is, I've always wanted to do a performance of the scatological canons of Mozart because they're wonderful and too filthy to perform on your average concert. But I thought in Ojai we could get away with that. So sort of created this incredibly long, like, half of canons, maybe 45 minutes of canons, climaxing with the Bach extra canons from the Goldbergs that Uri Kane's going to do a jazz version of. So there's that, and there's Ives' sonatas, which is also very much music about music, music about music making, about revival meetings and hymns and marches. And
I don't know if you know this, but Uri was our composer in residence for several years, and we did an event at the Jazz Bakery, which I think no longer exists, but this was a number of years ago, where at 8 o'clock I played the Goldberg Variations. Complete. And then at 10 o'clock, he did his jazz version with his trio.
Nice.
It was thrilling. And those of you who have never heard Uri, he's amazing. And the Mahler stuff is also fantastic.
Uh-huh.
And I know you have a chorus. You're going to do the Choral Fantasy, right? Is that sort of the...
Yeah, I thought, well, we wanted to get everyone together for one last hurrah. And this Ligeti and Ives and Beethoven in the last program is very much...
And you're going to play all the Ligeti etudes, right?
Yeah. Well, books 1 and 2.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
That's not actually all of them. Some of which you will also play on our concerts this weekend,
indeed.
Which is great. For those of you who are interested, Jeremy's, in addition to playing the first concerto of Beethoven, is going to play an unknown number of Ligeti piano etudes.
Until I get exhausted and fall off stage.
Right, right. Let's see. We do have one more thing to play before we open it up to questions. But it seems to me there was something I was going to ask you. But do you know what it was?
We never got into this because there was whole writing about music phenomenon and
right.
the questions and the problems of
right.
And I had all these, and you probably have this when you sit down to write program notes. Yeah. Either it's a very similar problem to when you're performing too. Either you're kind of dissolving in ecstasies of
right.
rapturous, the whirls of melody, and it's full of passion driving to the blah, 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 blah. Right. Or you have C major for several bars, and then you have the... So on the one hand, you have the facts, which are the notes, and the things that can be said without any ambiguity or metaphor, and you have the things that make it possible for people to read that, right? and that's a very interesting tension between... It's the same way, like the piano playing is, of course, the notes, but then also whatever
right.
inspiration or you manage to. And when you're interpreting also musically, you want to be incredibly involved, but you don't want to be so involved that the structure dissolves into a jello, right? And, yeah. and that's the same problem with writing about music.
You know, it's really interesting that you said that what makes it possible for people to read about it. My pet peeve about program notes is that I personally find that 95% roughly of the program notes that I see, the way that I read them, if you can understand them, you don't need to read them. Mm-hmm. And if you can't understand them, then you don't need to read them either. And there are very, very few people who write about music. You know who else I think did that wonderfully was Michael Steinberg. Mm-hmm. But who write about music in such a way that a person who doesn't necessarily have the technical vocabulary, who doesn't necessarily even know what tonic and dominant means, still can relish the writing and get something out of it. And
it's very hard. I was just finishing up a piece on Charles Ives for the New York Review, and I had I really wanted to talk about this one particular piece that we're playing at Ojai. Just one more plug for Ojai while we're here. But it's the sum moment of the first violin sonata, which for me is one of the great masterpieces of the 20th century, one of Charles Ives' greatest pieces. Mm. And it's a piece built on the most idiotic of... do you know that? The old Elkin Bucket. The old Elkin Bucket. I wrote many rhapsodic and rapturous paragraphs about what Ives does, which is begins with the... and then begins to kind of... and begins to wander off. And then at a certain point, the piano begins to play in duples, a very Brahmsian thing to do. And then suddenly, by a few measures later, the duple has become this kind of insane. And the violin still rhapsodically in another. And for a long, kind of incredibly harrowing passage, the piano is marching in a duple and the violin is going off in this. And I wanted to explain in every element of that, every detail, yeah, every technical device is matched to an expressive end. It's about the nostalgia, and then you have the families at home, and you have the boys off at war marching, and you have the tenderness of nostalgia, and you have the violence of absolute separation, and you have the sense that a song that's about nostalgia, about memory, is actually fading into memory itself, and all the many things that are going on. It's an extraordinary passage, and I wrote, you know, four or five unreadable paragraphs of joy about it. And it took a long time to make two things that a normal person could read. Yeah, and it was very painful and unpleasant. But it'd be much, much more simple for me to just sit there and show you exactly, which is, you know.
Yeah. Well, shall we play one last thing and then we'll open it up to questions?
Yeah.
So we have one more very beautiful chorale prelude of Bach, also arranged by Kurtag. And this is Gottes Zeit ist der allerbeste Zeit.
Which means God's time is the best. The bestest.
God's time is the very bestest time.
I'm playing the top, right?
Yes. I think so.
Don't sit down, though.
So we have microphones out there.
Could I ask you to spell the name of the arranger of the Bach choral preludes?
Kurtag, K-U-R-T-A-G. He has a thing, but you'll find it.
He's still very much alive, I think.
He is.
Yeah.
Not a spring chicken, I think it's safe to say.
No.
Over here?
I think it was, Jeffrey, you pointed out an irony that I hadn't thought of before, which is that we think of Ives's music as so complex and so difficult for average people, whatever, the average music listeners to listen to sometime. But it occurred to me, and it hadn't before, that the way Ives juxtaposes popular melodies and his salad bowl thing is really not so difficult. But I was thinking of that in the context of classical era composers. And as a musician, and as a musician blessed with absolute pitch, I never think about the fact that I know when the second theme of something in sonata movement, in sonata form, is in the dominant or is in the relative minor. And I wonder sometimes how people who are not musicians, how that magic does something to their brains, and the fact that the end of the piece ends in the same key that it starts in. And if that convention didn't exist, would that matter to people who don't know, who would not recognize that the ending is not the same, you know, that it's not in the tonic as the beginning is?
That's a complicated question. Do you want to unpack that one?
Oh, it's a great question. I mean, the first thing that came to mind when you said the thing about the piece ending in the same key, I mean, I thought immediately of something like the Chopin Second Ballade, which doesn't end in the same key, and how that was pretty radical for 1830, whatever it is. And that was the kind of thing that started to happen more and more. But if I understood the question correctly, and please correct me if I didn't, but you were sort of saying, how does the brain of a non-musician process these events that we, you know, we experience them really intensely and we know what they are? I think that people who don't know what the relative minor is do experience them with the same kind of intensity. They just don't have the name for it. Right? Wow. I guess that was the right answer.
It's always nice also when people are, even if they're not by any means professional musicians, but if they play at an instrument, something about that makes them engaged listeners to a certain extent.
I mean, the wonderful thing about the question, if I can sort of direct it back to you, is that it really does go right back to this issue of words about music, because relative minor, I mean, that's the sort of what you were talking about, the noun versus the verb. Mm-hmm. Relative minor is a noun which describes a particular relationship between harmonies, and it's just, it's like, this is a table, like, so what? But what happened, the way, you know, the way that Schubert goes to the flat submediant, I mean, flat submediant, you couldn't ask for a more clinical sounding term for what is in fact one of the great miracles, you know, the moment in the B flat sonata where it goes from this to
right.
Something like that. I mean, these things that Schubert does all the time, and you can name it, right? But
we have a great tradition in music of taking our most beloved and beautiful moments and giving them the most heartless possible name. But that's just because there's a certain, you know, there's a certain allergy to getting too mushy.
Right.
When you're just talking about, you know, what a certain place in the music does, what the pitches do. So I understand that impulse, but you're right, it's a shame very often.
I have to tell one very quick story. I was playing many years ago, I played the Berg Chamber Concerto with Leon Kirshner conducting, who was a giant of a musician. He was a student of Schoenberg. He was a great composer, an amazing pianist, and great mind. And we got to the beginning of the second movement of the Berg Chamber Concerto, which begins with this amazing harmony. And he stopped, and he started reciting Dryden, Harmony from Heaven, from Heavenly Harmony, you know, that poem. And he said a few lines of it, and the orchestra's eyes got wider and wider, like, what's happening? And then he said, you know, he started saying, it's like, and he started using metaphor after metaphor after metaphor, and finally, Dave Taylor, the bass trombonist, you know, legendary, great New York freelancer, said, Leon, do you want it louder or softer? And this is, right? That's what you were talking about before.
Famously, Leon used any pretext to wander off onto a series of tangents, and a little bit like Charles, actually, in some ways.
Aside from transporting us to completely unique musical worlds, can you tell us why you juxtaposed the Beethoven 111 and the Ligeti Etudes? It's such a marvelous recording, and what's your fascination with Ligeti in particular?
I think I put the rationale of that combination in the booklet. Maybe I did or maybe I didn't. But the Ligeti Etudes are all about kind of bite-sized bits of infinity. Each one of the Etudes has a sort of journey from a relatively simple premise to this kind of unbelievable chaotic. And often the infinity will be, you know, an infinite rhythmic complexity or an infinite loudness, or everything will settle or send itself off to the edge of the game. Anyway, each one is this little concentrated trip to infinity and back. And then the last movement of 111, of course, is one of the greatest pieces ever, and is a very prolonged trip to infinity after all the kind of time worries of the first movement. It's always one of my things about that piece, is a really beautiful paradox hiding in 111, actually, that the first movement is completely consumed with the past, with C minor and works that he wrote before, and Bach and the Baroque and Fugue, and that's the one that's in a terrible hurry. Whereas the one that's looking to the future, the second movement, is as patient as can possibly be. And it's such a lovely time paradox hiding in that piece. And so that was the rationale. The ordering was not my idea. That was Bob Hurwitz's idea, and to put the Beethoven in the middle like a sandwich. I like it. It's unsettling.
Next question right over here.
Mm-hmm. In relationship to writing about music, music is magic. So how do you write about magic without revealing the trick? And all of the terms that you said, I'll give you a quick example. I'm a classically trained musician, grew up on the Allman Brothers.
Right.
And so the gentleman talked about relative minor. When I was like 13, I discovered if I play lead guitar in relative minor over the Allman Brothers, it was magic. And then someone said, oh, that's just a relative minor, which meant absolutely nothing to me and destroyed the magic. So that's my question.
Yeah, there's two ways to go. There's destroying the magic, or somehow by some alchemy increasing the magic by the words that you choose to apply. And so that it's not exactly like explaining how the rabbit is hidden in the hat. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that, Jeffrey?
You know, I was just thinking as you were talking about Opus 111 that one of my favorite passages, one of the great passages ever written about a piece of music was not written by a musician. It was written by Thomas Mann in the novel Dr. Faustus, where early on in the book, the character, I'm blanking out on who knows Dr. Faustus really well and remembers the name of the, it doesn't matter. There's a character in the book who's a musician with whom the protagonist, Leverkühn's, studies, and he is actually a kind of stand-in for Theodor Adorno. And he's giving a series of lectures in a little town in Germany. And he gives a lecture about Opus 111.
Yeah, it's a beautiful passage.
The second movement in particular. And Mann writes about that. He actually got a lot of help from Theodor Adorno, but he writes about that movement in particular. It was actually the very spot that you demonstrated, the trill, yeah, with a kind of insight and beauty and understanding that is...
It's hard to do.
Yeah.
It's rare.
And it's almost all metaphor. It's not, there's almost nothing technical in it.
Yeah, and even there are a couple mistakes.
Yes, that's
right. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Because somehow it's the truth.
But he captures the magic, yeah.
Yeah.
As a longtime Ives fan myself, I was very thrilled to see that in New York City they've just reconstructed his studio. Am I correct about that?
I heard that, yeah.
And I was wondering if you had ever been either, I don't know if his studio was originally still where he lived originally, or if this is the first time it's been sort of out there and open. But I was wondering if you'd been there. And what that might do to help you with this, to make you understand, you know, his music, or is it just fun to be where the master, you know, sort of in the ambiance of the master? But if you have not gone and you do intend to go, I would also love to see you think dank about it.
I know, I'd love to see myself think dank a little more often too. Yeah. But this was all precipitated, as you probably know, that the Ives had a house in Reading. And for those who are not big Ives people, you know, he sort of retreated into that house. You know, he was working in insurance and was in the city very often. And then once he got diabetes and his health collapsed, and he sort of more and more lived out in Connecticut, and he worked there. And he had this kind of tiny, very humble studio. And it's in Reading, in a very nice part, very expensive real estate there. And they were selling it. They actually ended up selling the house, the Ives house, to someone, but they were able to extract this studio and put it in my, five subway stops away from me, and then they have it there with the father's, his spinet and the cornet that his father played. And I haven't been yet, and I never was up to the house in Reading either, I'm ashamed to say. Of course, you know, so much of Ives' music is about memory and nostalgia and memorabilia, and this is a kind of obsessive love and tenderness for the music of his childhood. You know, it's kind of a Proustian project that he was embarked on. And this is what music was like when I was a kid, and so that studio being there is such a perfect sort of, it was his assembly of memorabilia, and now it's in New York, and it's so wonderful that this kind of somewhat underserved and underloved patriarch of American music has his place there. So, yeah.
Maestro Kahane, apropos of this conversation about magic and music, I wanted to thank you for the conversation series that the Chamber Orchestra put together a couple of years ago. It made me a tremendous fan of the Chamber Orchestra, and I'm sure it did the same for many. Thank you.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.